What if the greatest threat to your team isn't incompetence? Not a lack of vision, not even spiritual immaturity. What if it's something far more subtle and far more common? What if the real issue is that no one is telling the truth? Not because they're dishonest, but because they're protecting themselves, filtering, positioning, managing perception. And what if your team looks unified from the outside, but underneath is a collection of guarded competitors, each one spending more energy protecting their credibility than actually solving the problems in front of them? What if the very thing you've been trained to project, your strength, your competence, your unshakable confidence, what if that's the exact thing that's slowly killing trust on your team? Well, that's where we're starting today. And if you lead anything, a church, a staff, a ministry team, a small group, well, this conversation is going to expose something, and then it's going to give you a way forward. And it's all right here, right now, and only on the Five Gifts Podcast.
You're listening to the Five Gifts Podcast, a weekly show designed to equip leaders in the Spirit-filled church. I'm Bruce Ritter, and along with my co-host, Charles Russell, we offer insights for leading the local church in the fullest expression of Jesus. If you're interested in learning more about practical theology, the gifts of the Spirit, and spiritual disciplines, this is the show for you. Welcome to the Five Gifts Podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Five Gifts Podcast. I'm Bruce Ritter, here with the distinguished and stellar Charles Russell. This is season 3, episode 16, the first episode in a brand new 5-part series on team dynamics. Greetings, everybody. Good to see you, Charles. Hope you had a great weekend.
Absolutely. Great weekend. Had a great day of service yesterday. Great barbecue for lunch. And so just can't get any better than that. How about you, Bruce? How's things going?
Nice. We had family movie night with the drive-in experience right here at the church, and realizing that our parking light lighting is a problem for that. So we're going to have to go take a deep dive and work out the kinks in that plan. What are you preaching, Charles? I know you're helping out a church, and tell me what you're preaching.
Yeah, we're doing a series called it Navigating Holy Transitions. And really emphasizing the work of the Holy Spirit in leading us as we work through a process of leadership transition. So I don't know if the church enjoys it, but I've really had a good time preaching, and I've gotten a lot out of it. So it's been good for me.
Well, I'm sure you're enriching that congregation. That sounds like a really important season for them, and to hear probably some really good wisdom out of a series like that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been really good, and so anyway, I think great things and the great futures ahead for this particular church. So,
awesome. Well, why don't you take us through? Go ahead. You've got it.
No, I was just going to get started, but you got some more wisdom for us.
I was just going to ask you to glean right into our topic today.
All right, well, glean on. Here we go. Well, we've spent the last several episodes talking about theology anchors, and we tried to build out the theological foundation for some Spirit-formed leadership and community. This series applies that foundation to one of the most practically, even consequential areas of leadership, the team, because you can have the right theology, you can have the right vision, even the right strategy, and still have a team that quietly fractures under the weight of unaddressed dysfunction. Every leader says they value teamwork. Every church says they want unity, but very few understand what actually produces that at a structural level. And even fewer have been willing to address the thing that most consistently prevents it. So today's episode is called The Vulnerability Revolution. And it's all about redefining trust. Not the version most of us were trained to pursue, but the kind that actually produces a unified, high-functioning, mission-focused teams that we say we want, right? We're going to cover what we mean by the sin of invulnerability, that critical distinction between two fundamentally different kinds of trust, what it looks like practically to begin building the deeper kind, and finally, what happens to organizations when they don't?
Charles, I think when we talk about announcing a series like Team Dysfunction, I'm sure a lot of the thoughts and ideas about helping overcome that has to do with how you run meetings, how you work with staff. But mm-hmm. before we can talk about what healthy trust looks like, we have to name what gets in the way of it. And it's a really interpersonal kind of a dynamic, because the barrier is almost always the same, and it almost always lives in the leader before it lives elsewhere on the team. So we want to dig into some hard questions today, and something I think would be important that our listeners, as leaders, if they would sit honestly with this question before they answer it, and this is simply this: are you being strategically disingenuous with your team? In other words, are you filtering your words in meetings, saying something measured and safe when what you actually think is something quite different? Maybe you're nodding when you disagree with somebody. Maybe you're staying quiet when a decision is being made that you have serious reservations about, and then working those reservations out in private conversations after the meeting. Are you avoiding anything that might make you look uncertain, unprepared, or less than fully confident? No. Listen, I got to be honest with you, to read through those questions and to think through them, that's something I do. That's something I have to work on. And I think almost any leader would say, sometimes that's been an issue for me. And if any of that is happening, even subtly, even occasionally, we need to recognize we're not building a team. What we're doing is we're managing a room full of people who have learned by watching us. And what we're projecting is that the way to survive in this environment is to protect yourself. So let's call this thing that we haven't named yet, let's call it something. Let's call it the sin of invulnerability. That is a deeply embedded instinct to protect our image at all costs. And here's why it's so destructive. When a leader operates from invulnerability, they do not just fail to build trust. They create an environment where no one else feels safe being honest either. Remember, team culture always takes its cue from leadership. Leadership is upstream from the culture of your team. And so if the leader filters, well, the team filters. If the leader postures and positions, well, the team learns to do that too. And what you end up with is an artificial harmony. They're polished conversations, smooth meetings, and zero real trust in anything underneath it all. So from a leadership systems perspective, this is what creates what we would call a functional ceiling. You can only go so far as a team when people are spending significant emotional and relational energy managing perception rather than solving problems. And that is really the hidden tax of invulnerability. It's the price, if you will, of being an insecure leader. That's where every decision takes longer than it should, every conversation is slightly guarded, and every relationship operates at something less than its full potential. And I think over time, you feel it, even if you can't name it.
Man, that's powerful, Bruce. I don't think anybody enjoys paying taxes, but what a great phrase you've got there, the hidden tax of invulnerability. Whether we realize it or not, there's a cost. We're paying dearly for this sin of invulnerability. Well, look, if that's the problem, then we need to come up with a better definition of trust, because honestly, myself included, most leaders believe we already have it, right? And what we have is real. It's just not quite enough. And so in most organizations, including most churches, what we find is trust is defined around reliability. In other words, I trust you because you show up on time. You do what you say you'll do. You follow through on your commandments, on your commitments, not commandments, on your commitments. That's a real and very important kind of trust. We call it predictive trust. It's a trust based on patterns of behavior. that we've observed, you know, consistently over time. Then there's predictive trust. It's genuinely valuable. It creates efficiency. It reduces the friction that comes from uncertainty about whether people will deliver. But here's the limitation of predictive trust. It produces performance and not unity. So you can have a team where everyone's reliable, everyone's competent, everyone does their job well, but still lack the kind of relational depth that produces genuine synergy. And so people can perform in parallel without ever truly functioning as a unit. And then, now the breakthrough comes with a fundamentally different kind of trust. And this kind of trust is built on a different foundation, a vulnerability-based trust. It's not primarily about predicting behavior, but it is about knowing intentions. So it's the settled confidence that the people around you are genuinely for you, that your weaknesses and failures will not be cataloged and used against you, that you can bring your actual self, including the uncertain, unfinished, still figuring it out parts. You can bring all of that into the room without paying a relational price for it. As Bruce, as one of our mentors, would say, warts and all, you know, we just show our true selves and be who we really are. When vulnerability-based trust is present, you can say, hey, look, I'm sorry, I made a mistake, without the conversation being weaponized. You can say, I don't know what I'm doing here. I need some help, without it becoming a mark against your credibility. You can even disagree openly and directly rather than having to manage disagreement through some back channel conversations. And the effect of all that is it's not just relational warmth, it's operational speed, because the energy that was being spent on self-protection now gets redirected toward the mission. And so the hidden tax of invulnerability, it disappears. And teams that have built vulnerability-based trust consistently outperform teams that haven't, not because they're more talented, but because more of their collective capacity is actually available for the work.
Charles, I think you're talking about something that is profoundly a sign of maturity in any leader. But we recognize that's not easy. There is a challenge that every leader who understands this is going to run into. You cannot command vulnerability from your people. You can certainly model it, but it's hard to command that from people. You can't simply announce that the culture is changing and expect people to start being honest. You know, that has to be created through specific intentional practices, and it almost always has to be initiated again by the leader. Leader is the one that sets the tone for all of this in the team. So let's talk about how we break the armor, if we can. If vulnerability-based trust is the goal, and we think it's a significant, important goal for your team, well, the first practical step is humanization, because people do not trust titles. They don't trust roles or positions or organizational charts. They trust people. And trust between people requires context. That's an understanding of who someone actually is underneath the professional surface they present at work. So one of the most effective tools that we would recommend to create that context is what you might call a personal histories exercise or a personal histories inventory. It's simple. It doesn't require special materials or training. And it works. There are other kinds of expensive and very, very effective tools that you can look at. But here's something that you could just begin to work with your team. Just gather your team and ask each person to answer five questions. Where did you grow up? How many siblings did you have? Were there any childhood hobbies that you enjoyed? What was a significant challenge that you faced growing up? What was your first job? Or maybe what was your worst one? Now, on the surface, you know, those are questions that feel basic, but what they unlock is context. And context changes everything about how we interpret one another. Without context, we tend to judge behavior. With context, though, we tend to understand people better. And so the team member who seems arrogant in meetings may actually be deeply defensive because they grew up in an environment where showing uncertainty had real consequences. And the leader who seems rigid and resistant to change may be operating from a survival mindset formed decades before anyone in the room ever met them. And so the person who goes quiet under pressure may have learned early that speaking up wasn't safe. It was a threat to their insecurity. When context is present, though, listen, the default shifts from assigning negative motives to extending grace. And that shift from judgment to understanding really is the beginning of real trust. And not the end of the process, obviously, but the beginning. But it's the beginning that most teams actually never make because no one creates a space for it.
Wow, and what an important principle, that actually creating space to begin trust. I really like that exercise you're talking about, Bruce. And even as you were talking about that, I'm trying to think of different contexts and different ways to begin to use that and in different settings. That's a really powerful exercise. Simple, like you said, but not simplistic. But has the power to really create context and really begin to create some space for building trust on the team. Once the foundation of trust begins to form, something becomes possible that was not possible before. And it's something that most leaders have been trained to avoid rather than cultivate. So let's kind of talk about this for a moment. Healthy teams are not conflict free, right? And so I need to look this up so I can document it. It's a book that I read when I was doing my master's education. It was a book on conflict, and the author, he wrote this statement. He says, "Where two or three are gathered, conflict is in their midst." You know, so he's riffing off scripture. But man, what an absolutely true statement. Where two or three are gathered, conflict is also in their midst. And so, look, healthy teams, even the healthiest of teams, when you have people together, conflict is going to be there. And so we can kind of get lost in some confusion about, well, if my team's healthy, there won't be any conflict. Yes, where people are together, conflict abounds. And so so you got conflict and there's some confusion, and it can create some dysfunction in those ministry teams. Look, the absence of conflict is not unity. It is avoidance. Mm-hmm. And that needs to just kind of settle. If wherever you are hearing this, listening to this podcast, you need to kind of reconcile that statement. The absence of conflict is not unity. It's avoidance. And avoidance over time is far more corrosive to a team than the conflict it was meant to prevent. Real unity can handle the heat. In fact, real unity requires it. What we are describing is ideological conflict. Passionate, honest, direct engagement with competing ideas, different perspectives, even genuine disagreements about direction. But what it's not, it's not about personal attacks. Not the kind of conflict that happens when someone goes to three other people privately before they go to the person they actually disagree with. Open, direct, in-the-room engagement about the things that actually matter. So the reason ideological conflict is healthy is that it surfaces problems while they can still be addressed. When conflict stays hidden, when people nod in the meeting and dissent in the hallway, it becomes organizational politics. It fragments energy, it undermines decisions, and slowly it erodes the trust that the team has been building. So when conflict is surfaced and when it's engaged directly, we can call that progress because that's exactly what it is. Problems get solved, better decisions are made. And the people who lost the argument know that their perspective was genuinely heard and considered. And that's important. That's extremely important. And so this leads to what we consider one of the most important operating principles for any leadership team. We call it disagree and commit. Disagree and commit. It means that once a decision has been made through genuine open debate, the team moves forward as one, regardless of how the vote fell. You don't need consensus. What you need is clarity. So people don't need to get their way on every decision, contrary to popular belief. What they need is to know that their voice was genuinely in the room when the decision was made. When people weigh in, they buy in. And once commitment is made, there's no second guessing, there's no undermining, there's no quiet campaign to relitigate the decision through back channels. The team moves together. The team moves as one. The team moves together in unity.
Charles, what a powerful statement about unity. I think that clears up some confusion to have about the difference between consensus and clarity. And I think you stated that really well. And here's why that matters. So a leadership team that cannot have honest conversations models filtered communication for all the teams beneath it. A leadership culture where conflict is avoided produces a church culture where conflict goes underground. A team where people are protecting themselves rather than serving the mission trains everyone who reports to them to do the same. So the dysfunction compounds. And by the time it becomes visible at the congregational level, in the petty conflicts, the back channel conversations, some of the politics we talked about that begin to form in the hallways, the artificial harmony of people who have learned that the real conversations don't happen in the room, it has usually been forming for a long time at the top. So the symptoms are recognizable once you know what to look for. If you begin to look for overly smooth meetings where nothing of substance gets surfaced, decisions keep getting revisited because they were never fully committed to the first time, conflict that bypasses direct conversation and shows up instead as withdrawal or passivity or sudden explosive moments over issues that seem too small to warrant that much heat. Well, these are not independent problems. They're symptoms of the trust deficit that started somewhere upstream. So addressing it requires intentional leadership, and sometimes it's painful leadership. I hate to think of it like this, but it's the best example I can think of. It's like resetting a broken bone. There's situations where you have to break something before it can heal correctly. And old patterns of filtered communication have to be named and interrupted. New expectations have to be set and modeled before they can be required. And almost always begins with one person deciding to go first to model the vulnerability they want to see before anyone else on the team has demonstrated it is safe to do so. And Charles, we all know who that person is. That person is the leader.
Oh, the leader, I thought it was the person I hired. I didn't think I had to take on that responsibility. Well, you've burst my bubble, Bruce, but thank you. You're correcting me. No, absolutely. Man, the leader has to go first. The leader initiates. The leader makes the first move. And so, man, you're exactly right. Well, let's try to bring all this together and try to land the plane, I guess, with something practical for this week. So if you want to begin building the kind of trust that we've been describing, there's three concrete starting points. First, we would suggest audit your own invulnerability. Before you address anything on your team, sit with the honest question of where you are protecting your own image rather than leading with transparency. What are you not saying in meetings? What disagreements are you managing privately rather than surfacing directly? And what would change? What could change if you went first? Second would be to mine for conflict. if your team meetings feel consistently smooth and easy, that's almost certainly a warning sign rather than a sign of health. Start asking the hard questions. Invite the disagreement that people are probably managing politely. Create the expectation that honest engagement is not just tolerated, but in this team, it's required. And then third, establish the disagree and commit principle explicitly. Because most teams have never been given clear permission to disagree openly and clear expectation that they will commit fully once a decision is made. Name it, model it, and then hold the team to both sides of it.
Yeah, and here's the question we want to leave you with this week. Where is invulnerability quietly eroding trust on your team? And then what would it look like for you to go first? Not to announce a new culture, but to, and not even to roll out an initiative, just to go first, to model in one meeting or one conversation this week, the kind of honesty you want your team to eventually be able to practice with one another. Remember, trust doesn't scale from the bottom up. It always moves from the top down. And everything starts with whether the leader is willing to lead the revolution they're asking for. Listen, if this conversation is surfacing something in your leadership and you want help navigating that, we'd love to talk with you. You can connect with us at charlesrusselltraining.com or charlesrussellministries.com or coachingcardia.com. And we can offer leadership coaching and spiritual life development for leaders who want to build teams that actually function the way they were designed to. So next episode, we're going to go deeper into the dynamics that either accelerate or sabotage alignment with your team. And we get specific about what happens when teams move from trust building into genuine collective health. So we'll see you next time, next week, on the 5 Gifts podcast.
You've been listening to the 5 Gifts podcast. If you would like to take the next step as a spiritual leader, we invite you to visit either of our websites or contact us for leadership coaching. We can help you reach the next level in your own growth and leadership. We provide leadership, spiritual gift, and personality assessments that give you a better grasp of your leadership style. And we also create a customized growth plan that empowers you to reach your full kingdom potential. We can't wait to hear from you.